Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you tonight?
Man, I'm doing great.
Man, that's exciting.
I know. This is good. This is good, man.
I actually believe it.
I know. This unsolved stuff's getting good.
I believe it when you say it.
You should believe it.
All right, Gibbs, we got to give out some Patreon shout-outs. I want to give a shout-out to Shannon Kilcrease and Shetty Versado. Shetty and Shannon for being new Patreon supporters. We appreciate it very much.
Absolutely.
Anyone can help support us on Patreon. All you have to do is go to www.patreon.com/truecrimeallthetime. You'll find all of our information on there. All right, Gibbs, you ready to get into our latest unsolved case?
I am.
We're talking about the Doodler.
The Doodler.
So the Doodler is an unidentified serial killer believed to be responsible for as many as 14 murders, 3 different assaults of men in the gay community of San Francisco, California. This all occurred between January 1974 and September of 1975. So we're not talking a long span of time like some of the cases that we do. But then also, you know, you and I talk about MO a lot of these killers that we talk about on the show. And this guy, and I'm assuming it's a guy, has a very, very specific MO.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, everybody that he kills is a member of the gay community in that area of San Francisco. A lot of it occurs in the Castro district, which is, you know, kind of a famous district there in California, in San Francisco. The one thing I will say is that the exact number, and we say this a lot, right? It's really hard to pinpoint the exact number. We're going to walk through and talk about some of the victims that are really known.
Right.
But we're not going to talk about 14 because it's not 100% sure that that's the number.
Right. It's just speculated that it's that number.
But you see that number a lot when you're researching the Doodler. It says 14
right. In
a lot of different places. But then when you actually start to research the victims, you can't find 14
right. They're not victims. They don't mention 14,
right.
You know, actual names.
But I think they believe that that the number is somewhere around there. But I think one of the reasons why it's hard to pinpoint, though, is in large part due to such a high number of gay men that were killed during this time period. You know, I think it was a very, very high number.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and we're going to talk a little bit about some other famous cases that were going on at right around this same point in time. So you've got a lot of murders happening in this area. I don't think they can figure out exactly how to tie each one to who.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some assumptions going on that it, you know, this one was part of this one. This one was part of, you know, kind of mix and mingle them in.
Yeah, I definitely think that. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Doodler's nickname. So, Gibbs, I think I picked this one because I was drawn in by the name, the nickname, right? Every serial killer seems to get a nickname. And the Doodler just seemed to be a very strange nickname.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean,
It's not Slasher.
No.
It's not.
It's kind of light. It's kind of Disney.
Yeah,
Disney-esque.
Yeah, it's Doodler.
Yeah, Doodler.
And, but the reason for the nickname is because, you know, the killer had this strange, well, I shouldn't say strange, but had this habit of sketching his victims prior to some type of sexual encounter and ultimately a murder.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, this guy was meeting his victims at, you know, gay nightclubs, bars, restaurants, you know, specifically targeting gay men.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about
that. No doubt about that. 100%.
That was, you know, his MO. Now, there were a lot of theories that are posed, and one of them that's very interesting that the police put out there is that this person, the reason why he's targeting gay men in and around the San Francisco area is because he feels shame over his own homosexual tendencies or experiences.
Okay.
I have no idea if that's right or wrong.
It's a theory.
But it's a theory that's out there.
Yeah.
Now, I think we have to talk a little bit about San Francisco, and specifically that we mentioned the Castro District, right? That was, you know, back in the early 70s, it had a very large gay population. But one thing that really comes out in the research of these murders is that the people residing in this area, they really don't trust the police, and they really don't feel like they were doing their job when it came to trying to apprehend this guy. And they're thinking it's because they were gay.
Well, yeah,
all the victims were gay.
Yeah, I think their theory, their or assumption on their side was that they were a lower class citizen, right? Because they were gay.
Well, I think
they didn't matter as much as somebody that was.
I think they felt the police felt that way,
right?
And because they felt that way, they were not giving this case the attention that they would say the Zodiac, the zebra killings, which were like those I was going to talk about. These are two other big high profile cases going on in the same area around the same time.
Yep.
And so what you see, and I don't think this is an assumption, I think this is was proven out, is that those two cases got all of the media attention, news, print.
Well, this was the mid-70s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I 100%, you know, they weren't going to cover this the way that you would probably cover it today.
Well, and I think that's one thing that I kind of thought of as we were researching this, right? We're 2017. The world is a much different place, thankfully. And especially as it relates to, you know, the LGBT community, you know, my kids, they don't think about any of that stuff. You know, they don't have any, what's the word I'm looking for?
Prejudice?
Yeah, prejudices or biases against any of anybody.
Oh, I mean, the kids today, it's a different environment because you don't have, like you said, you don't have them thinking about that. You don't have them thinking about race or creed. They just don't think about those items like they were thought about in the 60s and early 70s.
Well, and I would
even 80s.
Yeah, and I would have to assume that that's because the adults changed, you know, the thinking changed as the years went on.
Oh, sure.
From generation to generation.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, these were some pretty heinous murders. And we cover a lot of heinous murders.
We do.
And in the grand scheme of things, the coverage back then
was minuscule.
It was hardly anything. Yeah. And so along with that, I think, you know, the police, the willingness of the police to really put a lot of resources and effort into solving this case didn't go to the extent that it did in a lot of the other cases that they had going.
I agree. Yep.
So we touched on the zebra murders. You know, those were happening in 73 and 74. So, you know, basically right before and kind of overlapping.
So they were in San Francisco?
Yeah. And the zebra murders, I'm sure we'll touch on them maybe on our other podcast, but it's basically a string of racially motivated murders. You know, it dominated the headlines. It was a really big deal. And in part because you had a lot of white victims.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But then, you know, you had the Zodiac that was still at large. Now, he operated mostly in the late 60s. He may have operated in 70. But by the time of the doodler, he was in the wind. But they were, he was still active. They were still searching for him.
Yeah, and they were still throwing his name out if they could associate him with
Hall. Oh, yeah.
Right.
And it was still a huge case. And I guarantee you, even that much later in time, probably still getting more press than what the doodler did.
Yeah.
But so all that did was just increase the frustration of the people in the gay community that, you know, the doodler murders were just not getting the media coverage, and they knew why, and that made them frustrated. And I think they should have been frustrated.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit, you know, about the murders. It was a pretty consistent method in the ones that we're getting ready to talk about. Many of them were stabbed both in the front and the back. So that kind of tied pretty easily. It was pretty easy for him to tie some of these together. Police theorized that all the victims had died after meeting with the suspect near the locations where their bodies were recovered. So unlike a lot of other cases that we cover, you know, there was no movement, right? There was no, at least that's what they theorized. It wasn't like they were killed in one part of town and driven and dumped somewhere else. The theory was that they were killed pretty much where they were found.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically, you know, and it's a sad fact, but living as an openly gay person in the 1970s was not the easiest thing to do, right? I think we can all admit that. Not from personal experience, but, you know, you have to know from everything. That
absolutely.
Not only that, but, you know, it wasn't easy. But when you look at this case and some of the other cases, I mean, it could be potentially life-threatening.
Yeah.
I mean, they were being targeted, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, you had to be careful going out, you know? I mean, you're going out in the town, going to go have dinner, have drinks.
Right.
And then you had to worry about, you know. And of course, they didn't know there being the whole way that he was getting them to, from what I understand, the way he got them to leave with him is he would come up and he would do this doodle of them, right?
Yes.
And then persuade them to come home with him, to leave, so he can sketch them in greater detail.
Yes, I that's the way I have it too. All right, Gibbs, so I think we need to talk about the very first victim, and that is Gerald Cavanaugh, and he's found on January 27th, 1974, around 2 a.m. in the morning. His corpse is found at the water's edge on San Francisco's Ocean Beach. Cavanaugh is 49 years old, and he had been stabbed multiple times. And coming from the coroner report, it looked like it was determined that he had been conscious at the time he was killed.
Yeah.
And that he had attempted to resist his killer because he had a lot of self-defensive wounds.
So he sliced up on his hands and arms, maybe?
Yes, definitely. Now, one thing is I think they said he had only died a few hours before. And they were basing that off the fact that, you know, his body was showing signs of slight rigor mortis, but it wasn't in full rigor.
Okay.
And I do think what is very interesting is how they found the body. And that's that Cavanaugh's wearing, basically he's in full dress. You know, so underwear, shoes, socks, a shirt, pants, and a jacket. He's got 20 some dollars in change in his pocket, and his watch is still on his wrist.
So it doesn't look like robbery.
No. Yeah. So I think you take out robbery, and I mean, at this point, you know, you take out, well, I don't think you can take out sexual assault, but it doesn't seem like a sexual type of assault.
Right. Cause he's fully closed.
Right. And so either if that happened, then he was redressed later on after he was, yeah, I don't know. But you know, there's really very little known about him The guy came from, he was born in Canada in 1923. And even originally, they couldn't figure out who he was for quite a while. He was, for a short amount of time, he was known as John Doe number 7. He was balding. He worked in a mattress factory, 5'8", weighed 220 pounds. I mean, there's just not, you know, nothing really stood out about him. You know, he was Catholic and he'd never been married. I mean, that's really all the information that you can find on Gerald Kavanaugh.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't have known at the time that if he was gay or not either.
Yeah. Right. No, I don't think they would until they, you know, would have started maybe trying to find his friends and interviewing people. And, you know, obviously once they identified him, they probably would have figured that out.
Figured it out. Yeah.
So the next victim is Joseph Stevens. And Joseph really went by the nickname Jay. And it's spelled J-A-E. And Jay's body was discovered by a woman walking along Spreckles Lake on June 25th, 1974. Jay was 27 years old and had really died recently, you know, not too long before being found. Some of this they knew because, you know, in talking to people, they figured out the last time he had been seen was just the prior day. So, I mean, they knew they could narrow the time.
Yeah, they knew it was less than 24 hours then.
I would say that plus the rigor mortis and, you know, they can.
Right. Other science.
Pretty much figure out the time of death. But Jay was very interesting because, you know, he was a female impersonator and a comedian living in San Francisco. The theory by police on this one was that Jay was alive with somebody at Spreckles Lake. And I think they even thought that he was with the killer by choice. So let's throw a couple things out. Obviously, this person, the suspected killer, was a good artist of some kind.
Must have been good enough to persuade people to leave with him.
Right, because by all intents, he's meeting people in these bars and different places. I think what they thought was he's drawing a quick sketch of them.
Right.
And that sketch must have been good enough to get these people to go somewhere else for maybe a more detailed portrait, right, or, you know, something like that.
Definitely an icebreaker.
Yeah. And so I think that lends to some of the theories that some of the victims went willingly, right, with this person to go somewhere. And it was once they got to that point, that's where they were killed. So Jay had been stabbed 3 times. There was blood in his mouth and nose. Jay was born in Texas. We mentioned, you know, by all accounts, a pretty popular female impersonator. And it worked at a place called Finocchio's. And Finocchio's was an old-time club that put on, you know, that kind of female impersonator type shows. But it apparently had been around since like 1930. And back in the 70s was a pretty famous place. All right, Gib, so let's talk about the third victim. And that was Klaus Christmann. And Klaus Christmann was a German-American immigrant.
Clearly, Klaus.
Klaus.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Definitely, yeah. No doubt about it. Was discovered by a woman that was walking her dog. This was on July 7th, 1974. Now, Klaus's death was quite a bit more violent than the previous 2 murders that we talked about. You know, his throat was slashed in 3 different places. He was stabbed at least 15 times. So there was a lot more violence. Inspector David Toski, who everybody should know, was the famous detective in the Zodiac case, described this murder as one of the most vicious stabbings that he had ever seen. You know, Toski was a 20-year veteran of the department. And in San Francisco, he was one of the two main investigators on Zodiac. At the time of his death, Klaus Crismann was wearing a tan leather jacket, black side zipper ankle boots with brown Cuban heels. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but
sounds expensive.
Yeah, those side zipper ankle boots are old school for sure.
The 70s and 80s, yeah. A lot of business people wore those.
He had so I'm trying to paint this picture because he's got on like a white Italian shirt.
Sounds pretty savvy.
Orange bikini briefs, it was said. A blue moonstone ring. I mean, this is all very 70s stuff. So you have to think of it in those terms. And he's got a brown ring, but he's also got a gold wedding band. Now, originally and I think this happened with a lot of these victims, when the newspapers ran their first stories, they did not know who these people were because they had not been identified yet, right? Back then, it took a little longer sometimes to identify victims.
Oh, sure.
Longer than it does today. But the paper there in San Francisco, the Sentinel, it ends up publishing a photo that basically somebody took in the morgue.
Wow.
Which is really, really odd.
That is, even today's, I mean, there's some pretty bad sights out there, but still.
Very, very strange to think about. Somebody went into the morgue, took this guy's picture, and splashed it across the paper.
Mm.
Now, I don't know what page, because by all accounts, as we said before, this didn't get a lot of attention, so I'm sure this is not on the front page, but still very odd.
Still, how'd you like to come across that during your morning coffee?
Yeah, I don't think that would fly today. Now, it flies on the internet because everything flies on the internet.
Right.
There was a couple of other things about Crismann, and that was that he was found with a makeup tube in his pocket. Now, I'm not sure what a makeup tube is.
Oh, either. I'm just going to speculate that it had like lipstick or maybe foundation or eye stuff in it.
I don't know. You and I shouldn't be speculating makeup because we just don't know enough. I get my daughters down here to go through their Ulta and Sephora. And they'll be able to tell me what it was. What the police thought about this makeup tube, right or wrong, was that it was suggesting that Crismann had homosexual tendencies.
Yeah.
You know, because remember, he's found with a wedding band.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so at this point, they realize that he's married and he has kids. I don't think they say how many kids he has.
I have two.
You do have two?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's got a wife and two kids.
Two kids. So I think at that point, they knew that he was a closet homosexual.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe that's what their theory was based on, you know, all the evidence that they had. Now, what I understand is that Crismann had been staying with friends and he'd only been in the city for about 3 months.
Okay, short time.
Yeah, not very long. And after everything is said and done, his body ends up being returned to Germany and he's buried in Germany. So I don't, you know, my thought is that his wife and kids were not with him in San Francisco. He was in San Francisco for several months without them.
Right. Maybe on business. Who knows?
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that at this point, there's been three murders and the police are able to connect the three pretty easily because they're all very, very similar. You know, we talked about the stabbing, both the front and the back, all of these things, you know, were similar with all three in some way.
Right.
And they tied them together.
And of course, they were all homosexual, so that added another level to it.
Yep. They tied that in together. And I think the other thing that they were able to figure out was that apparently each one of these incidents involved the victim meeting someone who suggested driving to a remote area. Cause you know, keep in mind, all three of these bodies were found in somewhat of a remote area, right? One was a beach, Golden Gate Park, you know, things like that. And again, we talked about being stabbed front and back. Now, the one thing we haven't mentioned, and one of the reasons why some of these were John Doe for a while, is even though it wasn't like a robbery situation, you know, because he left money and he left the watch on the first one, but he did take their identification. So that, I mean, that led to the police having a much harder time.
Sure.
Identifying the bodies.
Right.
And it caused them to be John Doe number whatever.
Whatever at that time.
For a period of time.
And they probably had a few John Does at that time if they had the Zodiac and the Zebra and this guy going on, right?
Yeah, because as we go down through the list, I think somebody's like number 80-something.
Yeah.
So they, yeah.
And it's also San Francisco, so I'm sure there's some high crime rate, murder rate anyway.
Well, it's a big city, sure.
Sure, yeah.
But they definitely had a number of John Does, you know, throughout this time period. But again, you know, this comes back around to the level of trust between the police and the gay community and what was going on in this, the Castro district, where they thought a lot of this originated from. And there was a quote from a very popular gay businessman in town there that said, quote, "If gay men were assaulted for being gay or robbed, the cops thought gay men had it coming to them, much as they thought women had it coming when sexual assaults happened to them." The example that this guy was getting from cops is that, quote, "I can't believe you would just walk into a bar and take somebody home." So again, we've talked about this on a number of podcasts, that regardless of the scenario, nobody ever has this stuff coming to them.
No.
But it shows you, and maybe I'm harping on it too much, but it shows you really what it was like.
Well, this is that mentality back then.
Between the two sides.
Yeah.
Right? The lines had been drawn, and right or wrong, and I lean towards probably there was a lot of truth to some of these things that were being said, but this is the way that the homosexual community felt at that time. All right, Gibbs. So let's talk about the next victim, and that's Frederick Capen. And Capen's found on May 12th, 1975. Now, this is nearly a year since the murder of Klaus Christman.
That's a good amount of time.
Right.
And for a serial killer?
Had waited a year.
That's kind of atypical?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some where, I mean, obviously we've talked about a lot about the definition of a serial killer.
Right.
Three or more with breaks in between.
Right.
But it's kind of, what is the break? Is it a month? Is it 6 months? We've seen some that have waited a year.
Yeah, we have.
But to me, that's a long time.
It almost seems like there could have been something unaccounted for.
Maybe.
We don't know.
It could have been a stint in jail. Could have been.
Yeah.
You know, but if what we think is right, which is a lot of times that, you know, these people are driven, they've got an urge to do what they need to do, mm-hmm. right? To satisfy this urge.
Right.
A year is a very long time to be able to put that urge at bay, wouldn't you say?
I would say. So you say, so what are they doing in their life that is satisfying that urge?
Right.
Right. I mean, well, BTK was one.
And maybe it could be as simple as this person was operating somewhere else.
Could have been. They could have been a different part of the country, different part of the world.
Doing the same thing.
You know, that's just that unknown.
Or they, like we said, they could have been put in a situation where they didn't have access.
That's true, too.
Like jail
or
something like that. But anyway, he does wait a year, so I mean, there's some significance to that. Now, Frederick Capen was 32, and he was found by a hiker behind a sand dune. Now, this guy was 6 feet tall, but he only weighed 148 pounds.
That's skinny.
That's very, very skinny for a guy that, you know, with a height of 6 foot.
Yeah, because you're 6 foot.
6 foot two. But yeah, I weigh a lot more than 148 yeah, pounds.
A lot more.
Unfortunately. So Capon is found wearing a blue corduroy jacket. Now, I have to keep reminding everybody it's the 70s. So you're going to, you know, you got a lot of corduroy floating around.
What's wrong with corduroy?
Gibby still wears corduroy.
Absolutely. That way you hear me coming when I walk.
He's got a multicolored shirt, blue jeans, brown socks, brown shoes, jacket and shirt completely blood soaked. And again, the coroner comes out and says cause of death is stab wounds. Now this time they were mostly in the front around the aorta and the heart. So it wasn't X number in the front and X right. number in the back. It seemed like they were mostly
in the front
chest stabbings. Now keep in mind that he's found behind a sand dune, like we said. So there were marks in the sand where he had been dragged.
So you could see signs of struggle or just where the body was dragged and put in a different position.
Yeah, I don't remember reading anything about signs of struggling. What I remember was that it was about 20 feet of what I assume is like heels.
I gotcha.
Being yeah. dragged through yeah. the sand.
Right.
And then maybe up and over the sand dune, and the sand dune is kind of hiding the body. Now, a little bit about Capon. He was a medical corpsman in the Navy. He had received a commendation for saving 4 men under fire in Vietnam.
Yeah, he was a hero.
Yeah, he was a war hero. Yeah.
Capon was a registered nurse, and because of that, this is how they were able to identify him, because the fingerprints they took at the scene matched up in the database.
So because he was a nurse, he had to have his fingerprints on file, I assume?
I'm guessing probably yeah. to work at different hospitals or whatever he did.
That sure. makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
You're just like, sure, whatever. Please stop.
Yeah. Then I'm thinking, but Askry, is that the guy in Kentucky that we did the story on in right. Cincinnati, right? They didn't fingerprint him, and he was doing all kind of shit.
Exactly. All right, Gib, so we get to the Doodler's last victim, and this is where it was kind of strange, right? We talked about it in the beginning. Everything you read says that there are 14 victims of the Doodler. But really, when you start to research it, there's really only
like five.
Five that are can completely be tied together.
Right.
So I think the police are making some assumptions based on other killings that have some similarities.
That happened in the area.
Happened in the area. Right. But this guy's name is Harold Goldberg. And he was by far the oldest of the victims as well. He's 66 years old. Now, this was the guy that I said at some point. He was named John Doe 81 because he's found on June 4th, 1975 on a golf course. 10 yards off the trail, and his neck is completely slashed. Now, this one, to me, is a little different. This guy had his pants unzipped. He had no underwear on whatsoever, and he'd been dead for about 2 weeks. So, again, I mean, to the point where, and, you know, they can figure all that out by maggots and fly larvae and all that. But apparently it was on his face. You know, it was really disgusting.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing about Goldberg that I think was a little different from some of the other ones as well is this guy was not a healthy individual. I mean, the coroner's report said basically that his liver was failing him and he would have died. Not, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of time to live anyway.
Right. He was living on the edge.
Yeah. So in that respect, I have a hard time putting him with the other four because of his age, of his health. It doesn't seem to fit a little bit.
Yeah. But, you know, again, I mean, just because of the age, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I shouldn't.
I think clearly he likes to drink if his liver's that bad.
Oh, yeah. He had pretty much cirrhosis.
Yeah, and we know that the Doolittle hangs out at a lot of bars. That's where how he picks his victims.
Yep.
So maybe he thought this was just an easy target. You know, an older guy.
Yeah, you could be right.
Yeah.
You could be right. So we finished up with the victims. And we really start in with the investigation. And it's about 5 months after the last known victim that San Francisco PD releases a composite drawing of the suspect. And as you've mentioned, they said he was known to frequent a lot of the bars and restaurants in the upper market and Castro areas. I had mentioned Castro. I hadn't mentioned upper market before. Now, the one thing we have not talked about is this composite sketch shows an African-American male between the ages of anywhere from 19 to 25-ish, somewhere around there. He was described as anywhere from 5'10", 6 foot, something like that. Tall, slim, and that he wore a navy-type watch cap. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but... A navy-type watch cap. So some type of hat.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the...
Yeah. I don't say he's making these gestures.
I'm making gestures to try to explain to Gibby what I'm talking about, but...
Maybe someone will put a meme together for you.
Or they'll say, why didn't you look that up, you dumbass, before you said it.
Yeah.
So Gibbs, I think the really interesting part of this and what's so important, besides the fact that they now have this composite drawing of the suspect, which we know is always important.
Absolutely.
But this is why you will see this serial killer listed also as the Black Doodler. Because we come to find out through, you know, witnesses and things that helped compile the composite that it's an African-American male.
Okay.
Now, I call it the Doodler because I don't think there's any reason to say the Black Doodler, but I think it's important for listeners because you may see it that way.
Back in the day.
And this is the same case.
Okay.
Whether you see the Doodler or the Black Doodler, it's the same.
It's the same case.
We're choosing to go with the Doodler.
The Doodler.
Did you just say the Diddler?
I said the Doodler.
I swear I'm going to play that back, and it's going to say the Diddler.
It's the Doodler.
Doodler. All right, so Gibbs, we know that the police are doing some investigation. They're canvassing the bars where the victims were probably last seen.
Right.
And so, obviously, they get somebody, some type of witness or witnesses that are where they're able to put this composite sketch together.
Right.
But they also learn a lot about this guy through some of these witnesses to the point where they put out a statement that says the killer had a quiet, serious personality, had an upper middle class education, and had an above average intelligence. Now, I don't know what witness is able to or witnesses are able to put all of that together. Cause it seems like very, very detailed information.
I think so too. So I can see where they get some of the things that they're saying about them, but I don't know how they get so much detail. Cause as far as we know, there's no like FBI profiler involved, right? I mean, I haven't read anything about how any FBI profiler got involved and was giving them backstories. And for somebody to have that much detail about someone, then wouldn't they have like their information so they can be investigated?
You would think.
I mean, that's a lot of detail.
I mean, you got, let's say you have somebody sitting in a bar.
Right.
And they remember seeing an African-American male with a victim.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, were they actually sitting with them to the point where they were able to tell that, hey, this was a really smart guy. He an upper middle class did they talk about each other's education?
Yeah. I mean, how would you get that? Yeah. Even if you had a few drinks with someone, I don't know if you would be able to pull that type of information out of somebody.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to tell you that I barely finished the eighth grade.
Well, we already know that, but
I'm not letting that out of the bag.
No.
But, you know, they do talk about that he's possibly an art student. Now, that's not much of a stretch.
Well, no, because we know that that's his whole thing, right? I mean, he's
an artist, the doodle.
Yeah.
You know, he does that type of thing. But one thing in particular that he must have told directly to a witness was that he was studying commercial art. And they have his sketches.
Oh, they have sketches.
They do. Yeah. They have some of his sketches. But as far as I know, and I could not find any. My understanding is that they were locked away for evidence, but they were never shown to the press. Now that doesn't make any sense to me, because it seems like that would be, now of course these were probably drawings of victims. So they got to think about that, but wouldn't that be something that maybe somebody would recognize and say, I know who draws like that.
Yeah. Like a handwriting analysis, just a picture analysis.
Yeah.
So in today's world, they would, wouldn't they? They would put that out there, don't you think?
Well, so why haven't they put it out today? If you're saying...
Well, yeah, I don't know.
They could still put it out right now if they have it.
That's true.
I'm not even sure if they still have them.
Right.
But at the time, I think they had some of his sketches. Now, we're making this guy sound like he had a lot going on for him, right? Middle class education, above average intelligence. The guy's going to commercial art school. But the police also believe that this individual has a history of mental issues. And
shocker.
Yeah, it's not a shocker. Almost everybody that we talk about does.
Right.
But they go as far and get as specific as saying he has a mental difficulties specifically involving sex.
Okay.
There was one paper, Gibbs, back in the day at the time all this was going on, that reported that the suspect had a sexual identification problem and was undergoing psychiatric care on an outpatient basis.
So, meaning that he had a hard time identifying himself as being a homosexual man?
Or I take from that an issue identifying whether or not he's male or female?
Female? Or straight or gay?
Having a problem with some type of identification.
Right.
You're right.
Yeah.
It doesn't say what the exact type of identification is. But I think it has to be one of those two, most likely.
Clearly, he took his frustration out on his victims then, is what I'm
I think that's the theory.
Guessing. Yeah.
That because he was having problems coming to terms or with his identification process, and I don't know if he was upset that he was homosexual and did not want to identify that way, even though he
didn't like having those feelings. So he would be maybe with these men, have those feelings.
And he would, that's why he was targeting gay men.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's some, obviously I won't say it makes sense because none of this stuff makes sense, but you can see where maybe that was the pattern.
Sure.
The biggest issue in this case is that, you know, they had some witnesses, and we're actually going to talk about three witnesses that survived the doodler.
Wow.
The problem is none of the witnesses were real interested in cooperating with police. And the feeling is that these people did not want to be exposed as being gay. You know, they were not out.
Yeah. They were still in the closet and wanted to keep it that way.
As you would say. Right. Yeah, they didn't want to be outed.
Yeah, in jeopardy of their job or their
And apparently one may be very, very famous. And we're going to get into that, you know, here in a minute. But, you know, the police would come out and they would say stuff like, we'd really like to talk to anybody who's been attacked or that has had contact with this person that tried to draw a sketch of you. You know, they said, we'll keep your information confidential. But there again, how confidential can it be? If you're going to come along and name a suspect, you're going to end up in a trial.
Yeah.
And your name's going to be out there.
Your name's going to be out there.
And in the 70s, if you were, especially if you were a famous person and you had engaged in, you know, some type of homosexual act, but you were not known to the public. So think like Rock Hudson.
Sure.
Remember Rock Hudson?
Oh, yeah.
Had all the leading man roles, was a sex symbol, you know, I think knew that he was homosexual for some time.
Right.
But also knew that he could not come out.
Oh, it would ruin his career.
Because his career would be over.
Yeah.
Now, it's funny because Rock Hudson's name is thrown around.
Okay.
On the internet as being, well, I'll just get into it. It, you know, basically what's said is that there were three surviving witnesses. One they know for sure was a European diplomat who was in the United States. Apparently, he met the doodler in May of 1975 in the upper market at a restaurant. And the doodler asked this European diplomat whether or not he had cocaine. They go back to the diplomat's apartment where he stabbed 6 times. So it wasn't just like he was, he was literally stabbed. The doodler tried to kill him.
Yeah.
Now, when it came to talking to this guy, you know, he denied that he'd had any sexual relationship or relations or whatever you want to call it with the suspect. And that's where, you know, everything kind of broke down. So they get nothing from this guy that they call the European diplomat.
So he didn't want to collaborate at all.
No. I mean, he didn't want to say anything that he would have to testify to, I believe.
Sure.
Because he didn't want to, what I'm thinking is he didn't want to tell the entire story because some of the parts of the story
would have outed him.
Would make him, in his mind, look bad.
Right.
Yeah. Now you get to this surviving witness who, by all accounts, was some type of entertainer. And I think this is kind of fascinating because according to police, they never released this guy's name that I know of. But he was, they said, quote, nationally known. So to be nationally known in 1970, and again, this is like a mystery wrapped up inside another mystery.
Right.
Wrapped in a riddle, wrapped up inside of an enigma.
With a bow on it.
But no, it's like a secondary mystery,
right,
of this doodler case is who is this nationally known figure that they're talking about? But again, think 1970.
Sure. You know, yeah.
It's not the Kardashians. We don't have.
No.
Everybody gets their own
TV show.
That's, you know, you're not nationally known unless you're a movie star.
Yeah.
A rock star.
You're a huge name.
Or in a big time television show. And again, they didn't have 800 channels either.
No.
So I think it kind of narrows it down a little bit. Or sports. I should mention a sports star. Could have been. So I think that's one of the one thing that's, you know, very interesting is people have tried to speculate who this person is for a long time. And that's where I said, you know, the Rock Hudson name came up. There were a couple of other actors whose names came up. But there was one reporter that was asked to, you know, to speculate on who he thought it might be. And his direct quote is, "I don't know who it is, but the one thing you have to remember is that airfare from LA to San Francisco is very cheap."
Okay.
So what that means to me, and again, this guy could know nothing at all.
Right.
But he's thinking that this is a well-known figure in LA.
Sure. Hollywood.
That is flying to San Francisco. So to me, that means movies.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, really, it's your well-known entertainers would have probably been a movie star back in that day.
It depends on what you mean by well-known, but to me, it's either big rock star, big movie star.
Right, because TV people at that time weren't as big. Not like they are today.
As they are today. I don't know. Sanford & Son was pretty big, you know.
Yeah. Well,
Red Fox. Red Jeffersons. Fox. That's what I watched.
Not that big, though.
So the third surviving witness that we talked about was some type of well-known San Francisco figure. Now, again, never, as far as I know, released the identity. I couldn't find it anywhere. But this got to him so bad that, you know, he basically left the city and wouldn't answer phone calls, letters. He never wanted to talk about it again.
Messed him up.
Yeah. But again, I don't know who that person is either. So,
because they won't release that type of
information. That's kind of a mystery. Now, they did take, and they had tons of suspects. One in particular, they actually took into custody when the guy entered a bar and he offered to start drawing patrons of the bar. So very suspicious when you got a serial killer out there named the Doodler and you're going to go in and start offering to draw people. But along with this book of sketches that he's got, he's also carrying a butcher knife. So that's like a double whammy, right? That's not making you look very good at all.
No, not at all.
They booked him on carrying a concealed weapon and actually ended up charging him with aggravated assault because he attacked the police during the interrogation.
Really?
Yeah. So this guy was like a really good suspect. But here again, there were tons of suspects, but it all is going to go back to the fact that they have all these witnesses
and survivors
and nobody is willing to cooperate.
No one's willing to go all the way the distance with it because they're in fear of the backlash,
the repercussions,
right, of their careers or whatever.
Yeah. And so I think this is kind of different from a lot of unsolved cases we do where, you know, either there's a bunch of suspects that they cannot tie to the case because of evidence, or there's really no suspects in some of these. They've got tons of suspects and they've got the means by which to kind of tie them together.
Right.
But what they don't have is any cooperation from the people that could do it.
Yeah. Which is bizarre in today's world.
In today's world, it would be bizarre. Thinking back of what some of these folks were going through, I mean, you can see why there would be big time reservations about stepping forward and putting yourself into that place of having to be that person. In July of 77, Gibbs, the police said they had another really good suspect. They were questioning. And apparently this guy came in and he talked pretty openly up until the point where he would not confess to the killings. But he was saying a lot of things that maybe even they thought only he could know or only the killer could know. So the police were really certain about this guy, at least to the point where he was somehow involved in the killings. You know, they maybe not by himself or whatever.
Right.
But somehow they knew this guy was involved. But again, the same problem crept back up is that no matter how much the guy talked, he didn't come out and outright confess to the murders.
Yeah.
So they would have needed court testimony of the survivors. Now, keep in mind, in 70, again, no DNA.
Right.
So we might talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure there was, they kept all this clothing and everything from the victims. But in the 70s, there was no doing anything with DNA. So it's about a week later, after the police had been talking to this suspect. And again, we're getting a lot of this reporting from some of the newspapers. This one came from the Sentinel, and that it said that the police department knew, thanks to an anonymous tip, they now knew the license plate number of the suspect's car. And they had even spoken to the psychiatrist who treated what they were calling the doodler.
Okay.
I mean, they literally putting this in the paper.
So they got all that information out for the public to see.
Yeah. And apparently the psychiatrist told investigators that the suspect admitted during a session that he had committed all of these brutal slayings.
Wow.
So again, they got a lot of information. Sure. If this is, you know, real, true. But again, we go back to the biggest problem is that the survivors and the witnesses and really the only people that could really put the doodler away, they just refused to do it.
Yeah.
No matter how much evidence or no matter what came up, no matter what the suspect was that they were talking about, they just didn't want to testify in court as to who their attacker was. It wasn't worth it for them.
Right.
I think in large part because some of these people, they were prominent people. You know, we talked about, maybe one was nationally known. The other one apparently was a really big deal in San Francisco, at least. And they just didn't want to have to come out that way.
Yeah, they didn't want to ruin their career over.
Yep. So I think the next person we have to talk about is Harvey Milk. And I don't know how familiar you are with Harvey Milk. Have you seen the movie Milk?
I did.
It's very good.
It is a good movie.
It's a very interesting story. I thought Sean Penn was amazing. We don't review movies here, but
yeah, he played it well.
Yeah, so Harvey Milk, for anybody on the podcast that doesn't know, he was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And, you know, it was really kind of historic because Harvey Milk was a gay man and was elected to a pretty prominent position within the government there in San Francisco. You know, so it was a really big deal for, you know, the gay community. They came out and they supported him, and it really was just a huge deal. About 3 or 4 years after the killings, he was asked about this case in particular because he had gained some notoriety by this point. And specifically, he was asked about the surviving witnesses unwilling to cooperate to find this guy, to find this killer and put him away. And he said, and a little bit about, kind of reiterates what we've been talking about.
Right.
He said, "I can understand their position." These are quotes, by the way. "I respect the pressure society has put on them. They have to stay in the closet."
Yeah.
I think the problem with what Harvey Milk says is that it has an effect on, and we already talked about that this didn't get a lot of coverage. After he says what he says, the coverage goes down to zero. Even among the publications that are designed for the gay community.
Is he saying this because 80% of the gay population is still in the closet? Or
I think that's a statement he made as well.
Right.
Right.
So
I don't know if that's what caused the...
For the publications to shut down on
I don't know if it was that or if it was the fact that he was saying it was, he understood why.
Condoning
the fact that these, understanding why these people were not willing to come out, even if it would put this killer away.
Right.
I don't know if it's a combination of all of it.
Because basically he's saying, I mean, you're allowing the killer to continue, right? You're not willing to put the killer away. So you're saying he gets why these witnesses aren't going to help this case. So
yes,
a few more people could be killed, but that's for the greater good to protect these other folks. Privacy?
I don't know if he's saying it's for the greater good. Well, I just think
greater
he's,
good,
but I just think he's saying he understands.
But he says it in a very strong way.
He does. So, you know, again, as we're wrapping this up, we're 40 some years on.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this in other cases. Obviously, the longer you go, witnesses start to die off, or their memory gets much, much worse.
Right.
Now, the one thing we started to talk about it, and then I kind of moved away, was the DNA. I just wonder how much evidence they actually have and how much of it has been tested for DNA, because I really couldn't find a lot on it.
And from a lot of these unsolved cases we've been doing, it seems like when they do go back and test the DNA they do have, because it being age or because the limit ability that they have with the DNA, they can't get anything really good off of it.
Yeah, it's degraded.
It's been degraded.
There are a few things that will stand up forever, right? I think teeth, bones, certain things like that.
Right.
But obviously that has to be of the perpetrator.
Right.
Now, what the police normally find is maybe blood, hair that would come from the perpetrator that's left on the victim, carpet fibers. And there's a lot of that, not carpet fibers, but a lot of the stuff they would get DNA from, that type of stuff does degrade.
Yeah.
And I think to your point, even if they have it, they may not be able to match it.
Yeah, and back then, how well were they preserving
the
blood, the hair, the semen, that kind of stuff back then?
Yeah,
that's compared to how they're doing it today.
So I think, you know, we'll wrap it up by talking about it. So in August of 1978, there was a newspaper that was put out specifically for the gay community. It was called The Crusader. It's long since gone away. But it's probably the last newspaper to really cover the Doodler back then in depth. But the story in the headline is police are nowhere on Doodler killings. And basically the writer just went on this rant about how, you know, the San Francisco Police Department's not doing anything. And it was all about inaction, ineffectiveness, and he just let him have it.
He just ripped into him.
And at the very end, it says, I foresee more death.
That's a weird statement.
It is a weird statement. I think what he's trying to say is, because you're not doing anything, there's more people that are going to be killed.
Right.
But it is a very kind of eerie.
It is.
Odd statement. Again, I don't know. Will this one ever be solved? I guess it could be. I would have to assume that some of these witnesses are dead, that the three that they talked about.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, we know if it's Rock Hudson, he's dead.
He's dead.
Again, I think it's a very interesting case because of the circumstances and how it affected, you know, this one segment of the population that was very, very condensed in this Castro district, right?
Yeah.
Back in the 70s, the Castro district was the place to be for, you know, a gay male.
For a gay man.
Because they, from my understanding, is people were coming from all over.
Yeah, and I believe it.
Because to go to the Castro district.
I know that they referenced the whole Doodler in a movie with Al Pacino. Where he
did, what was it?
I think it was called Cruisers or Cruising Cruisers, where he plays a gay man hitting up the night scene.
It was set in San Francisco.
Yeah, and they talk about the doodler sitting down at the end of the bar sketching.
I don't think I've seen that one.
And it was also referenced in a book, but I can't remember the name of the book at this point. But again, it was because it was, I don't want the word iconic. It's not iconic, but it's well known in that, in entertainment industry for that area. Because like you said, that was a hot zone, you know, that's where gay men went. And I think when people write a book about that time in the '70s about gay men, they pull that into their, they would have
because the Castro section is where I think they felt the most accepted.
Well, yeah, sure. Because I think it was, Harvey that even said there were something like 80,000-90,000 gay men in that district ward or whatever that he was at. So that's quite a bit.
But I also think that's why this case had such an effect on that community.
Sure.
Because that was the place where they felt welcomed,
safe.
They felt safe. And, you know, they owned stores there.
Right.
I mean, it was like the haven for the gay man in the '70s.
Right. And someone comes in and interrupts that.
Yeah. Flow. And now they're killing. I mean, I think it lasted with them for a long time. Now, the sad part is I don't think anybody else, most other people didn't give a shit.
No.
And I think that's the sad part of the story, is that today, hopefully, we as a society would handle this so much differently.
Yeah, and I think we would.
And obviously the San Francisco Police Department or any police department would handle this, and the news.
Yeah.
Anybody.
It'd probably be looked at more, maybe potentially, as more of a hate crime.
It would definitely be a hate crime today.
So,
for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it for the unsolved case of the doodler. All right. Now, don't forget to check out our other podcast, True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.